This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. President Joe Biden is asking the U.S. intelligence community to keep pushing for answers on how the COVID-19 pandemic began. AP correspondent Sagar Magani.
Dr. Anthony Fauci says he and most other scientists believe the virus most likely occurred naturally.
But no one knows that 100% for sure.
And it's possible the virus emerged from a lab accident, a theory the Biden administration spent months minimizing. The president now says those are the two likely scenarios the intelligence community is considering, and he wants officials to redouble their efforts.
We have to get a better sense of the origin of COVID-19, and also how do we prevent the next pandemic.
White House spokeswoman Karine Jean-Pierre says the president wants a report within 90 days. Sagar Magani, Washington.
AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports there's now a third antibody drug available to COVID-19 patients.
The drug to be given as an IV treatment within 10 days of a patient developing COVID symptoms was intended for mild to moderate cases to keep things from getting more serious. It's intended for patients who are older or have underlying conditions that put them at greater risk of severe disease. The medication's developed by GlaxoSmithKline and Vir Biotechnology.
AP correspondent Jackie Quinn. Egypt and the United States said they would work together to reinforce a ceasefire between Israel and Palestinian militants as U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken visited Cairo and Amman on Wednesday. Egypt has long-standing relations with both sides in the conflict and played a key role in brokering the ceasefire after 11 days of violence in coordination with the United States. This is VOA News. The United Nations said on Wednesday that it's relocating around half of its staff as a precaution from the eastern Congo city of Goma, which was nearly overrun by lava during an eruption Saturday and has since been shaken by hundreds of earthquakes. More than 20,000 people are homeless and 40 still missing in the aftermath of Saturday's evening's volcanic eruption that sent rivers of lava towards Goma, killing at least 31 people and destroying more than 3,000 homes. The lava stopped just 300 meters short of Goma Airport, the main hub for aid operations in East Congo. A California community is still reeling after an employee opened fire at a California rail yard, killing 8 people before taking his own life. Santa Clara County Sheriff Laurie Smith says a man was still firing at the facility in San Jose when law enforcement rushed in Wednesday. Investigators offered no immediate word on a possible motive. Suspect's ex-wife tells Associated Press that he had a bad temper and would tell her that he wanted to kill people at work, but she never believed him and it never happened until now. Another candidate has been killed in Mexico, AP correspondent Mike Gracia.
Mexican authorities say a mayoral candidate killed in north central Mexico this week was the 34th candidate murdered nationwide ahead of the June 6th elections. Alma Barragan was killed Tuesday while campaigning for the mayorship of the city of Moroleon in violence-plagued Guanajuato state. Mexico's president said Wednesday the killing was without doubt the work of organized crime gangs. Observers say Mexican drug gangs want to place sympathetic candidates in town halls and city governments so they can operate without police interference. I'm Mike Gracia.
A new World Weather Agency forecast says it'll likely be so hot in the next 5 years that there's a 40% chance the globe will push past the temperature limit set by the Paris Climate Agreement. Thursday's report by the World Meteorological Organization doubles the chances it gave last year for 1 year to be 2.7 degrees warmer than pre-industrial times. The Paris Climate Accord tries to prevent that much warming, but already Earth has warmed 2.2 degrees. The report also sees continued drought in the U.S. Southwest and more strong Atlantic hurricanes. Amazon's founder, Jeff Bezos, has picked a date to step down as CEO. Bezos, who grew Amazon from an internet bookstore to an online shopping behemoth, said Wednesday that Amazon executive Andy Jassy will take over the CEO role on July 5th. A Seattle-based Amazon, Inc. announced that Bezos was stepping down as CEO in February, but didn't provide a specific date. Jassy, his replacement, currently runs the company's cloud computing business. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, May 27. And here are some of the stories we are covering. ECOWAS to hold an extraordinary meeting on Mali crisis next week.
The principle that the transition should be civilian-led remains, and that is normally a very strong position of the ECOWAS, which is supported by other international actors.
Kenya's Kisumu City emerges as a new COVID-19 hotspot. Women are bearing the brunt of water shortages in Zimbabwe's second largest city. Some Southern African countries make inroads in cannabis production. And Zambia's president bans campaign rallies ahead of August elections.
Mr. Edgar Jagwalungu has attempted to emulate his colleagues in the region who have been dictators. But this is Zambia. We have a rich history of changing government through the ballot.
And a Kenyan court lifts a ban on donkey slaughter. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Mali's civilian transition on President Ba Ondaw and Prime Minister Mokhtar Ouane remained detained as of late Wednesday. They were arrested Monday by the military junta, and by yesterday, the military said they had resigned. The United States Wednesday condemned the detention of the civilian leaders and said it was suspending security assistance to Mali. The Regional Group Economic Community of West African States is preparing for an extraordinary summit next week on the situation in Mali. Until last month, Mohamed Ibn Chambers was the special representative of the UN Secretary General and the head of the UN Office for West Africa and the Sahel. He says Ondaw and Ouane were still being held and that it is difficult to say that both men would have resigned without duress.
Regarding the status of both the interim president of the transition, Ba Ondaw, and Prime Minister Mokhtar Ouane, it is evident they are still being held by the military in Camp Kati, and they do not have their liberty and freedom of movement. And the civil society groups in Mali are already protesting against this arrest of the president and the prime minister, calling immediate release, which of course the military have not as at this point either too.
What are you hearing, Mr. Chambers? Up to Wednesday morning, Mr. Ba Ondaw and Mokhtar Ouane were said to be under detention. What do you know in terms of their status, that they have resigned?
Whether they have resigned or not, well, obviously, under the circumstances, it is difficult to accept that they would have willingly done this without duress. The entire circumstances of the arrest by the vice president of the transition indicates that force was used to extract this resignation on the part of the president of the transition and the prime minister.
Until last month, Mr. Chambers, you were the head of the UN Office for West Africa and the Sahel. What did the UN and the African Union make of what took place in Mali? Was that a military coup?
Well, at the time the transitional arrangements were being put in place, both the African Union and the UN were working in tandem with the ECOWAS. As a matter of fact, as is normal in these circumstances, the ECOWAS was very much in the lead. And as far as the ECOWAS authority of heads of state and government were concerned, the situation in Mali was characterized as one of a coup d'etat, although, of course, we know the insurrectional nature of the removal of the former president, given the demonstrations that were going on in the streets in Bamako for a number of days on ending, which forced the former president to resign. But the manner in which the military took over the reins of government and wanted to run the country was rejected by the ECOWAS, which at some point was even forced to impose sanctions and various restrictions of movement of goods and services into the country. And this helped in ensuring a civilian-led transition. And this is how President Dao came in as someone who had retired from the military and was living a civilian life. This is how Prime Minister Mukhtar was selected. So therefore, the principle that the transition should be civilian-led remains, and that is normally a very strong position of the ECOWAS, which is supported by other international actors such as the African Union, the UN, the EU, and other partners.
Mohammed Ibn Chambers, until last month, was the special representative of the UN Secretary General and the head of the UN Office for West Africa and the Sahel. He is now retired and was speaking with us from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. A spokesperson for Zambia's main opposition United Party for National Development, UPND, says President Edgar Lungu is being hypocritical when he announced a ban on campaign rallies ahead of the August 12 presidential election. President Lungu announced the ban Wednesday while launching his own campaign. He said he was doing so because of COVID-19. The president called on the police and the Ministry of Health to enforce COVID-19 regulations and guidelines. UPND spokesperson Cornelius Mwitwa says President Lungu is taking a lesson from other African dictators, but he says Zambians believe in changing their government by the ballot.
Well, there is nothing new that has happened. This is actually in keeping with what the Patriotic Front has been doing ever since 2016 general elections, where the opposition were by and large banned from holding political rallies. Each time you wanted to hold a political rally, they would use police to deny the opportunity, claiming security concerns by the security forces, and then putting out that particular meeting or rally, whereof the police officers that would turn up to try and stop that rally would outnumber. But that's the kind of Zambia that Mr. Edgar Jagwalungu has attempted to emulate his colleagues in the region who have been dictators. But this is Zambia. We are very upbeat about it. We are very confident about it. We have a rich history of changing government through the ballot. We've never changed government through the bullet. And therefore, we feel that these maneuvers will actually one day, the chickens will come home to roost.
The president said that he imposed the ban on political rallies because of COVID-19. Don't you think he has a point?
Well, the point is this. From the time COVID hit the world, from the time COVID came to Zambia, has Zambia registered even 100 deaths or 1,000 deaths of COVID for all this period? The answer is no. Zambia is recording one of the highest recovery rates of COVID. And the COVID deaths that are being recorded as COVID deaths, a number of them are questionable. The COVID situation, we have explained it to the people of Zambia and to the world at large, that we as a country and as a region and by and large as a continent, we thank God for this kind of unexpected gift and favor that he has awarded the continent, particularly for us as Zambians. Whereas COVID has hit the world left, right, and center, we have not really suffered the severity that we are able to witness on TV, and we sympathize with the countries that have been so hard hit.
The president announced the ban on political rallies when he launched his campaign. The UPND, have you launched your campaign already?
We haven't yet launched our campaigns in terms of a national campaign, but that banning, whatever it is called, whether he was banning his own political party that they will not be participating in rallies or whatever it is, we are going to stand tall to that. We're not going to be muzzled around. We will stand to any form of political pressure, whatever it takes. We will stand up. We know the people of Zambia are geared for anything. And take this from me now. The rallies that are going to be held from now until the 12th are not supposed to change the mood of the nation. Perhaps just a psychological addition to the way people already perceive things. This campaign is already over. For us, the way we're looking at this rally is not really a selling point. Messages have already been sold through community radio stations, through various tabloids, social media space, which has been open for a very long time. If we went to vote today, Zambia is already decided. It has been a matter of time. These rallies, whether they go on or they don't, for us, the rallies are just a bonus. They are just a psychological satisfaction just to show off the numbers that are going to be turning out at our rallies.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, and God bless.
Cornelius Mwitwa is the spokesperson for Zambia's main opposition, United Party for National Development. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lusaka. Kenya's western city of Kisumu now has the country's highest number of confirmed COVID-19 infections, passing the capital, Nairobi. The jump in cases comes a day after an opposition leader addressed large crowds in Kisumu, which also reported Kenya's first case of the variant first spotted in India. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
According to the health ministry, the county of Kisumu is recording a high number of COVID-19 positive cases. The Lakeside City Tuesday recorded almost a third of all 382 positive cases recorded in the country. Kisumu County Health Minister Boaz Otieno says the outbreak has escalated over past 10 days or so.
We are in a major, you know, transmission zone. To date, we have over 4,000 cases that have been confirmed as at the end of last week. And about 300 or so of them had been diagnosed in the last 7 days.
Otieno blames Kisumu's increase on the easing of restrictions in the capital, Nairobi, and surrounding areas.
There was an inevitable rebound influx. Generally, there's a lot of traffic between Kisumu and Nakuru and Nairobi. So if you confine people and then you release, the tendency is people to kind of, you know, rebound and go back home.
In late March, President Uhuru Kenyatta restricted people's movements in Nairobi and in the counties of Kajiado, Nakuru, Kiambu, and Machakos in an effort to contain a rise in COVID-19 cases. The president eased restrictions a month later. Health officials have warned the country may witness another wave of cases in July if people continue to disregard health protocols designed to limit the spread of the coronavirus. The increase in infections comes as Kisumu County prepares to host an Independence Day ceremony on June 1st that Kenyatta is set to attend. Leonora Odinga is a Kisumu resident who has a mixed feelings about the upcoming event.
I may be worried, but at the same time, I may be anxious to see my president come and talk to us. Some of us, we had not even seen him. We need development. And without development, we cannot prosper anywhere. It is the people who have to take precautions to take care of themselves.
2 weeks ago, Kisumu was the first town in Kenya to record a case of the Indian COVID-19 variant. Otieno said there is nothing to worry about and health protocols will be followed during the ceremony.
For the main venue, we'll have a very limited number. The stadium, I'm told, has a population capacity of over 30, but it will only allow 3,000 people in by invitation, and the seating will be very controlled. Ensuring of masks and washing of hands will be ensured.
Kenya's Health Minister Mutahi Kagwe said Tuesday that at least 950,000 people countrywide were vaccinated against the coronavirus. The East African nation has recorded 169,000 COVID-19 cases and more than 3,000 deaths from the disease. Mohammed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, May 27th. Women are bearing the brunt of water shortages in Zimbabwe's second largest city of Bulawayo, despite recent heavy rains that have eased a devastating drought. Ade Gondo gives us more on this story.
A report by the Women Institute for Leadership Development, WILD, has revealed that water shortages in Bulawayo expose women to physical violence and sexual abuse. Successive droughts forced residents to rely on wells and bores. Bulawayo City Council announced in February it was resuming normal supplies as water levels in the dams which supply the city rose some to more than 50% of capacity because of the rains. But Bulawayo remains under water rationing and in some cases water cuts, pressuring women to fetch water for their families, which often involves long walks with heavy loads that can cause long-term problems. Gender activist Nosi Pomoyo says the physical toll is unbearable.
The issue of water shortages has brought more abuses and violations against women. This is noted firstly at the water collection points, where women need to up their muscles against men as there is a struggle to access the water. So there have been issues of body shaming, name calling, and people have normalized that. And also when it comes to the home setup, with the pressure of having water for washing, cooking, all the basic needs, it has given the rise to other domestic violence issues.
Moyo says the COVID-19 lockdown has exacerbated challenges for women and is causing displaced aggression and physical abuse in the home,
where women can actually perpetrate violence against their children, which is also a reflection on how they're also treated by their men. So we should understand the water shortage and the water challenges is not just an issue, a challenge the city has alone, but also there's evidence that it brings issues of violations.
The Bulawayo Progressive Residents Association, BPRA, concurs, saying the city is failing its residents in its mandate of supplying water consistently. Tembelani Dube with the association says erratic supplies are hard to accept given the good rains this year.
Bulawayo City Council is not sticking to the water rationing regime that is supposed to be 450 liters per day per household. But instead, you find that instead of water rationing, there is water shedding completely. Some of the suburbs go for days. Now, where I'm staying, there is no water. And the effects of this to the women is that they are forced now to go to unsafe sources of water, which may also be a danger to their lives because they have to go to these streams that are in the bushes to fetch water. And that puts their lives at risk.
Council has given assurances several times that it is doing its best, but is dealing with an obsolete system. Critics counter that there is a lack of political leadership from the central government to deal with the problem. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
Banned across Africa, cannabis has long been farmed illegally for recreational use, but that is changing. The global demand for cannabis for medical purposes is slowly allowing Africans to benefit. As Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg, some countries in Southern Africa are vigorously making inroads into this valuable resource.
From an outlawed plant to sought after treasure. This is the tale of the cannabis plant in Africa. Southern African countries are wasting no time in getting their share of this pricey commodity. Tiny landlocked Lesotho has beaten other countries to become the first African country home to a company licensed to sell medical cannabis to the European Union, EU. Lesotho's MG Health is the first cannabis cultivator and manufacturer in Africa to meet the EU stringent manufacturing practice qualifying for exports. Luke van der Nest, a business development manager at MG Health, calls it a bold step considering that it's an industry estimated to have the potential to earn Africa up to $7 billion by 2023.
It is a massive achievement, not just for us, but for Africa. And I think it really does open the door for the whole continent to prove that this is something that companies in Africa can achieve. We have the skills, we have the infrastructure to be able to do this, to now compete on a global scale from all over the continent.
Cohen Anton from the Cannabis Trade Association Africa wants more farmers to be given full access to this resource.
The industrial hemp industry needs to be fast-tracked. We don't need heavy licenses. We don't need over-regulated environment, because at the moment, the marijuana sector is locking out a lot of people, especially the traditional farmers. with these high regulatory hurdles that people need to jump through?
He says not only can cannabis be used for medical purposes, but cannabis sativa strains like hemp can be used to make industrial products.
So hemp is very low in THC. It doesn't make you high. It has over 4,000 different uses, from plastics to paper to building to homes to bricks to cement, and also for therapeutic purposes.
South Africa now permits cultivation of medical cannabis. However, the laws have also gone a step further, permitting the backyard cultivation of cannabis for personal use, not for sale. A report by Prohibition Partners, a market intelligence firm, shows that South Africa's cannabis industry could be worth $23 billion by 2023. And one cannabis expert, Tentron Birch, has opened a cannabis academy in anticipation.
We teach you to grow from seed to harvest, teach you about medicinal cannabis, how cannabis works with the body. Then we have cannabis business, which covers extraction, supply chain, project management, the sort of back end of how the whole industry works.
Zimbabwe has legalized the growing of cannabis for medical purposes, but under strict regulations. Experts say the industry has emerged at the right time for African farmers. However, the cost of establishing a cannabis farm is a minimum of $200,000, pricing many of these farmers out of the market. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Kenya's donkey population is under threat again after the High Court lifted a 2020 ban on donkey slaughterhouses, allowing them to resume selling the meat and hides to Asian markets. The high price for donkey hides for use in Chinese medicine has led to donkey poaching and sparked fears that the animals could eventually go extinct. Brenda Molinya reports from Nairobi.
Helena Simeon, a Maasai farmer living in the border county of Kajiado, drives her herd of donkeys in search of pasture. For years, she says women like her have relied on the donkeys to ease the burden of labor in their homes and on their farms. She says, we get our earnings from our donkeys. We use them to help us in our work. We fetch water with them, we carry luggage, we fetch fodder for our cows, and sometimes we'll sell them to earn money to educate our children. This reliable source of labor is now under threat once again. In early March, Kenya's High Court lifted a ban on the slaughter of donkeys for both meat and hide for medicine in the Asian markets. Donkey slaughter was legalized in Kenya in 2012, leading to a rapid decimation of the animal's population and cross-border theft. Josiah Ojuang, the program's director for the African Network for Animal Welfare, says these developments are likely to reoccur.
There were very many issues that were coming up of donkey thefts, of slaughter of underage donkeys, of cross-border even smuggling of donkeys. But most importantly, communities were losing their livelihoods because the abattoirs were slaughtering very many donkeys a day, much more than naturally the donkeys can replenish.
The Kenya National Bureau of Statistics said in 2019 that the country's donkey population had decreased over the previous 10 years from 1.8 million donkeys in 2009 to just 1.17 million in 2019. Ojuang says this figure is now expected to decline even further with the renewed slaughter of the most significant and profitable domestic animals in Kenya.
These slaughterhouses were slaughtering about 200 donkeys a day, sometimes 250, but they have an installed capacity of at least 1,000. So if you look at even our current population, if they continue slaughtering at that rate, which is too high, it will be a few short years before the population of donkeys in Kenya gets almost decimated.
Kenya has four donkey abattoirs spread across four counties. The four haven't resumed operations yet, as they are waiting to get approved by the licensing authorities. When that happens, activists say donkey numbers will resume their downward slide, presenting a real problem for rural women of the country and the region. Brenda Molinya for VOA News, Nairobi.
And that's it for this Thursday, May 27th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Button, Washington, saying, have a good day.